Thank you. Well, thank you, Neil, and thank you for the opportunity of being able to be here again. Hugh, how many years ago was it since I came to be with you all?
I think it was 2017.
2017. Bit of water under the bridge since 2017. Excuse me. I actually live about 15 minutes drive away from another Guildford in Western Australia. And if I'm not mistaken, I think you want to be named after that Guildford. Would that be right? Yep. I'm here today to bring a very heavy subject. Well, it could be deemed a heavy subject. It's related to the Holocaust. And it's related to what happened to the Jewish followers of Jesus in the Holocaust. And with any subject touching the Holocaust, there's a lot of death. Okay? You cannot get away from it. It's a terrible subject. And it brings you very, very close to the reality of the words that Jeremiah wrote in 17:9. The heart is evil above all things and desperately wicked. Who can understand it? However, we must always endeavour to look for the light in the darkness. Can there be any light at all in a subject related to the Holocaust? Well, I believe there is. But let's start off with a couple of scriptures related to light and darkness. John 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. Then in John 8, let me see if I can remember. John 8:12. Then Jesus spoke to them again, saying, I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. And then finally, Philippians chapter 2, verses 14 to 16. Do all things without complaining and disputing, that you may become blameless and harmless, children of God without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast the word of life, so that I may rejoice in the day of Mashiach, that I have not run in vain or labored in vain. So I guess in a sense I could call this presentation Light and Darkness, Life and Death. Some years ago, I had the great honour of being involved in two fairly important historic occasions. It was in 2017. And the first one was in a place called Beersheba in Israel. It was the 100th anniversary of the capture of Beersheba by the Australian, New Zealand and British soldiers. And that was important because that was the first victory in the capture of the land of Israel. And without that victory, there would have been no restoration of the Jewish people to the land. I had the pleasure of being able to give the historical presentation on that occasion, as we did a reenactment of the capture of the city. About a week later, myself, and I'm sure a few of you here, were also involved in an event at the Royal Albert Hall, when we were remembering the 100th anniversary of the issuing of the Balfour Declaration, the promise of the British government for a restored Jewish national home. And I recall that on that occasion, where I again had the honour of being one of the historical presenters, saying that had there not been a victory at Beersheba on the 31st of October 1917, the Balfour Declaration was just a useless piece of paper. There had to be something very tangible that went with it. And so here you have two historical events, which historically actually both happened on the same day, the 31st of October 1917. And those two events laid the foundations, you might say, for the restoration of the Jewish people. And they were high points in my personal life because I've been involved in these, in the research of these two matters for about 30 or so years, and primarily when I was working as the guide at Christ Church in Jerusalem. After that event was over, I was walking back to the taxi to go back to the hotel, and I sensed the Holy Spirit saying something to me. And he said something like, "That's it, Kelvin, job done." In other words, your work for the last 30 years has been completed. We got to a high point, in a sense, where we were able to present the reality of those historical events from 1917. And we see the reality today in the modern restoration of Israel. So I just had a little part to play in doing a lot of the research concerning these two events. And I worked on many of those research projects with Hugh over many, many years. And I'm wired in a certain way. That is to say, I've always got to have a project to be working on. Anybody else fall into that category? Yeah. And so I just had to wait now until the next project was presented. And it didn't take long. It's about 3 or 4 months later when a friend of mine called Reverend David Pelleggi of Christ Church in Jerusalem, some of you know David, presented me with a challenge. And he'd actually been presenting me with this challenge for a number of years, and I wasn't willing to take it up until now. And that challenge was to research and determine what happened to the Jewish followers of Jesus in the Holocaust. And David felt it was very, very important that we actually did discover more about these people and their testimonies, and in a sense, give them a voice, because they had no voice until now. Basically, there were 6 million Jewish people who died in the Holocaust, who were murdered in the Holocaust. We know about that. And many times, however, when you're talking about the Jewish followers of Jesus, they're not giving much credence at all. They're referred to as converts and so on. And David felt it was time to actually give these people a voice. And so I felt this was the time to begin to work on this research project. Now, there are times when you actually are given a challenge and you take it up very quickly. But so anything to do with the Holocaust, you've really got to count the cost. Because once you start delving into anything to do with the Holocaust, you are really touching the most darkest of things, of matters. It's the epitome of evil. Now, I guess that's why through the years when I lived in Israel for 25 years, I worked with Holocaust survivors and a hospital and looked after a gentleman for some months who had survived the bashing by the Nazis in Germany. And we had Holocaust Remembrance Day every year, and you're continually surrounded by this event. But you can actually hear about it and know about it, but you've got to keep it at some sort of a distance, because once you step over and get involved, you're getting involved in something which is very deep. And Hugh knows this because he's done a documentary specifically on matters related to the Holocaust. But this had a certain purpose in mind. It was not just a study about the Holocaust. It was actually to determine and discover information about the Jewish Christians. Okay? Today they're called Messianic Jews. In those days they weren't called Messianic Jews. They were called Jewish Christians or Hebrew Christians or converts or different names. In the Nazi system, they were called non-Aryan Christians. And in Germany at that period of time, in the time of the Nazis, they wanted to actually so-called purify Germany, make it an Aryan country, and Nordic and Caucasian and all that sort of stuff. And there was no place for anybody who didn't fit that categorization. And they were called non-Aryans. Now, a big problem was the church, because the Germans, the Nazis, wanted to use every institution possible to further their world view. They had a world view, okay, and it was a very nasty world view. It's a very racist worldview. And they wanted to implement that throughout society, so whatever institution there was, they would utilize that institution to further this worldview. Well, the church was a classic example, because most Germans were paid up members of either the Roman Catholic Church or any one of the Protestant churches. So it was, in a sense, it was natural that they want to bring their worldview through the church. And so from the very beginning, the church was on the radar screen. Now, in that period of time in Germany, there were tens of thousands of Jewish people who were involved in the church. in different ways. They could be completely committed followers of Jesus, or they could have been nominal. Okay, for several decades, Jewish people realized the only way to actually further themselves in society was to convert and be baptized and enter into the Roman Catholic Church, if you're in Poland, or the Lutheran Church or other Protestant churches. And that way they could actually not be regarded as Jews anymore, but they would actually be regarded as ordinary Germans and then get on with life. And so there were many people in that category in the church as well. But whatever, whether through true belief or they were nominal, they were, for their own purposes, they thought they were ordinary members of German society. But from the Nazi perspective, they were Jewish. Their bloodline stated they were Jewish. They had nothing to do with faith. The Nazi worldview had nothing to do with faith. It's all to do with your bloodline. And so Jewish people in the church were a problem. They had to be ousted from the church. So those people, those Jewish believers in Jesus, followers of Jesus, were called non-Aryan Christians. And it was a goal to rid the church of this group. Now that would give a challenge to church leaders, yes, because you want it to somehow be subservient to the authorities, and they say, listen, you can't have any Jewish people in the church. And some would say, right, well, we've got to follow the leadership, whatever they say we've got to do. But for others, they would say, hang on, no, you can't just come in and meddle with these matters. You can't just tell the church how they are to define who's a part of it. Okay, and so you had this challenge within the German church itself. And a lot of you have heard of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Martin Niemöller, and there's others as well. And in actual fact, there were many others as well who realized, no, this decision that's been made from on high is actually challenging the very character of the church. The church is the Jewish person, the Messiah, the Gentile person, the Messiah, together, okay, united. That's the church. That's the true church. Who has the audacity to come and tell the church how they should operate? Who should be in the church? So you can imagine this was a massive challenge within Germany in that period of time. And we have to recognise that not all Germans were Nazis. Okay? And there were many, many German people who did whatever they could in those circumstances to stand up for righteousness and for truth. And so there was a massive challenge there from the very beginning. Then when they made certain passed certain laws which said that Jewish people could no longer be in the civil service, that meant that any Jewish pastors that were in the church automatically lost their job. Okay, because in Germany all the ministers were paid by the government or some sort of system like that. I'm not sure how it operates. So you had this dynamic happening in Germany, and that was the ultimate goal. To purify the German church. So you had a conflict. There was what we call the confessing church on one side, and there was the Reich church, the Nazi church, on the other. There are lots of lessons we can actually learn today by looking at these dynamics that were happening in Germany in that period of time. Now, in my research study, I had to do quite a bit of reading, and you've got to, in a sense, get a bit of an idea of the bigger picture. And as I said before, anything to do with the Holocaust is very dark and very, very terrible. But there's so much material, I actually had to work out a model or two, which would help me with my research, because there was just so much stuff. I'd always felt that the Holocaust all had to do with the Germans wanting to murder Jewish people. So I'd always thought that from the time that the Nazis came to power, that was their goal. But as a result of doing a lot of background reading, I realised it actually wasn't the case. There were seven phases that I personally have actually worked out for my own purposes. The first phase was the period leading up until 1933. And that phase also includes the church, because there was a lot of anti-Jewish sentiment in the church, in anti-Semitism in the church. And so that was part of the foundations for this Nazi worldview. There were the ideas and impressions of Adolf Hitler himself. You can't divorce his own life story and life involvement with the Nazi worldview. There was German imperialism, okay, and pan-German imperialism at the same time. That was a factor. There was the whole thing about the Jewish people stabbing the German people in the back, which resulted in their defeat in the First World War. There was Darwinism, the influence of Darwinism and eugenics and all those things, which were very, very important. There was the occult. Again, a number of the Nazi leaders were strongly influenced by the occult. And so on and so forth. And also the influence of liberal Christianity played a huge part in Germany from the 1840s and 50s onwards, when more and more Protestants in Germany were actually ditching many of the fundamentals of the faith. But when you ditch the fundamentals of the faith, no creation, no virgin birth, no resurrection, when you ditch those fundamentals, well, what have you really got left of the Christian faith? And so something will have to come in and fill that vacuum. So it's a whole range of things that made up this Nazi worldview. But the bottom line was, when it came to the Jewish people, the Nazis didn't want Jewish people in Germany. So when they came to power on the 30th of January 1933, straight away they began to implement their worldview. And the next stage went into that period of 33 to 39, whereby they wanted to intimidate Jewish people, exploit Jewish people, and allow them to migrate, to go out of Germany and the Greater Reich. And so that was the next stage. And we can look at the negativities, but we can also be thankful that many Jewish people did manage to leave that area, and many of them did go to the land of Israel. So there's a positive aspect that many did survive. The third period, of course, is when the war broke out in Poland, and suddenly the Germans have control over 3 million Jewish people. What are we going to do with them? And so the decision was made to bring them all to a particular area of Poland and near the city of Lublin and make one big ghetto. Put all the Jewish people of Poland, and I suppose also at that stage from Austria, Czechoslovakia and Germany, and put them all into this one big ghetto. And to do that, they would actually first of all take Jewish people from villages to bigger cities and then in time take them over to this region. And so you had the ghettoisation period as well, primarily in Poland. But that was working very slowly. There were lots and lots of logistical problems with that. But nevertheless, that was their plan. Then in May of 1940, they invaded the Netherlands, Belgium and France. And when they captured those three regions, suddenly they have another 550,000 Jewish people under their control. What are we going to do with them? Are we going to take them all over to this area in Poland? That would make it very, very crowded, and that's a huge logistical problem as well. And so at that stage, around the time, before France actually fell, there was a proposal put forth. It wasn't a new proposal. Others previously had actually worked on this proposal, and that was to move all the Jewish people to the island of Madagascar, which was a French colony. And so they began to work on that plan. And how serious were they? Well, Hitler was involved, okay. And how serious were they? Well, they took a person called Adolf Eichmann and asked him to actually draw up the plans. And was this real? Well, when I first began to read about this, I thought, I haven't heard of this before. If I had, it would have gone in one ear and out the other. And I've cottoned onto it by reading the testimony of a non-Aryan Christian, that is to say, a Jewish person involved in the church, from Western Germany. And this lady was transported from Western Germany to the southern part of France. And I couldn't get my head around that. Why would the Germans deport a Jewish person, not just one, thousands of them, down to the bottom part of France? And being wired as I was, or am, I had to find out. And that's when I began to read more about the Madagascar plan. Okay, so they were beginning to make a beginning point, a start, to take them to the southern part of France and have them ready to jump on the boats and be sent to Madagascar. But the only problem was, after France fell, the only problem was there was a certain country, Hitler called them the land of the shopkeepers. Do you know who that is? That's you. That's what Hitler thought about you. The land of the country of the shopkeepers. Because Britain ruled the waves, and so they could not implement this plan to take Jewish people down to the island of Madagascar if Britain was not defeated, or if there was no peace treaty with Britain. And so the plans were still worked out, okay, in great detail. I've seen a copy. I don't know German, but I know enough to read the details of it. And it was all worked out, how they would do it, and they'd send them to Madagascar, and it would be a SS-controlled Jewish colony on the island of Madagascar. In the meantime, other things began to happen. Yes, they took those Jewish people down to this little place called Gurs in the southern part of France, and part of my research, being wired as I am, I had to go down to this place in the southern part of France. I had to see it. I had to feel it before I would really believe it. And it's all there. Now, the next phase was the Germans then invaded the Soviet Union. And that's phase four. And when they invaded the Soviet Union, they gave out orders that Jewish men of a certain age could be executed. Because Hitler's ideology was, the Nazi ideology was, that Bolshevism and the Jewish people were synonymous. And so the conduits for Bolshevism would be Jewish men, particularly males. And so, well, I just go and shoot them. It's basically the order that came out. It's called the Commissar's Order. And many German officers were not happy with this and resisted it as well. And so that began to happen. Thousands and thousands of innocent Jewish men, as well as Soviet officers in the army, were just summarily executed. And those executions were done by specialised murder squads called Einsatzgruppen. Now, in the midst of that, a letter came from Field Marshal Göring to the head of the 2IC of the Nazis, of the SS, sorry, the name is Heydrich, and that letter pertained to him being given orders to determine the final solution to the Jewish problem, inverted commas, okay? And within 2 weeks of that letter, something else began to become evident. Those murder squads were recording how many Jewish people they were shooting. This is terrible stuff, but it's reality. We may actually have to learn a lot of this stuff, because the principles behind it have never gone away. And so, suddenly, on those lists of Jewish people being shot, there appeared women and children. Previously, it was men of a certain age. Now, all men, plus women and children, in great numbers. When I say great numbers, I'm talking about thousands, tens of thousands, were being shot in the forests and other places in Belarus and Ukraine. So obviously, something was now happening whereby it had gone into a new phase. And the next thing you know, that within that phase, Jewish people from Germany were being transported over to the Soviet Union and were also being shot and murdered. Now, in that period of time, the overall head of the SS, Himmler, visited the region and began to realise there was a problem for the mental health of the executioners who were suffering from having to shoot so many people. Okay? They were still doing it, but it was affecting their mental health. And this is very, very tough stuff to contemplate. So they realised that there had to be another method of murder that was not so harmful on the mental health of the executioners. That's demonic. There's no other word to describe it. And so they began to look at other methods of mass murder. And that's when they came upon the whole idea of gas vans. They were put into vans, carbon monoxide would be put in, they'd be driven, and the people would die in that process. And so from that stage, it went into stationary gassing facilities, and that's when the gas chambers began to be implemented and thought about. So at that stage, orders were given for the establishment of 5 specialised murder camps, death camps, which are distinct from concentration camps. And the whole idea of those 5 camps would be that Jewish people would be taken there and they would be murdered. So that gets us into phase six, whereby the plan was to just indiscriminately murder Jewish people. The last phase, is phase 7, began on the 20th of January 1942, and it took place in an incredibly beautiful location called Wannsee House near Berlin, where the Nazis pulled together the heads of all the German government departments, foreign ministry, transport ministry, economics ministry, and so on and so forth. And there they said to each of these different representatives of the government, your job, I mean, first of all, they just outlined it and said, our task is to murder We've been tasked with this policy to murder 11 million Jewish people. 11 million Jewish people. All the Jewish people of Europe, North Africa and the Middle East. All the Jewish people under their control, as well as others, and they would actually work out diplomatic relations with those other countries, whereby the Jewish people living in those countries would be released and would be go off to the death camps. 11 million. 6 million were murdered. The plan was to murder 11 million Jewish people. And so all those different government departments were then pulled into this grand plan. And at the end of that day, when it was all finished, and all the different government departments had been manipulated and forced to actually give their assent, now the entire German political system was involved in this plan to murder 11 million Jewish people. That meant that henceforth not one single solitary Jewish person in all of that region was safe. They're all destined for death. And so from that day forward, the whole plan was to begin to implement this policy. And it happened in different ways in different countries. Sure, they continued to have the shooting squads, the murder squads in Belarus, Lithuania and Ukraine. And you also have to keep in mind that in many occasions these executioners were not Germans, were not even German Nazis. They were local collaborators, local anti-Semites in all these different countries. And so that was now the beginning point of the, you know, the real implementation of the plans to murder 11 million Jewish people. What about the Jewish Christians? What about those tens of thousands of Jewish people in all those countries who were churchgoers, who were involved in the church? Did being a member of a church save them or help them? No. In most instances, it did not. In most instances, the church, the members of the church who were Jewish, died in exactly the same way as all other Jewish people. Why? Because of their bloodline. Not because of their faith, but because they were Jewish. This is somber stuff, but it's reality. There are, however, testimonies of light in the midst of that darkness. The first completed work we did on the subject related to what happened in Poland, and there's a little book at the back called Basile and Anna Jotsch, Jewish Christian Victims of the Holocaust, and we actually managed to get hold of a whole file in German which related to their particular plight. It's quite extraordinary that information was actually preserved. But it's a story of the Netherlands that I'd like to finish my time speaking about today, because I've just completed this work on what happened to the Jewish Christians in the Netherlands. And their situation was slightly different to all the other European countries, whereby the church, actually the church leadership, stood up for the welfare of the and the safety of the Jewish people involved in the church. And there was a collective entity at a particular point. It's called the Interdenominational Consultation, whereby the Roman Catholics and all the different Protestant churches were involved. And the Nazis didn't like that. The Nazis didn't like anybody standing up against. They were so totalitarian, you know what I mean? Okay, might need a drink of water at some stage down here, folks, if it's possible. And so that's their system. They didn't want anybody to stand against them. But here, with the entire leadership of the Netherlands churches, they stood for at least 7 million people. Okay, they represented at least 7 million people. I'm not quite sure what the overall population of the Netherlands was at that stage, but those church leaders actually represented some 7 million. Thank you. And so the Nazis actually had to work out how are we going to break up this united front. A united front is something which totalitarian regimes don't like at all. And so they had to use a lot of seductive manoeuvring to break up this great union. And it happened in a certain way that they said, listen, if you stop, because once the deportation orders came, you see, the Jewish people didn't realise that they were going to Auschwitz or Sobibor to a death camp. They weren't told that. They were told they were going to a work camp in Germany. Okay? They didn't realize, the vast majority didn't know. Some had an inkling of it. But who would ever think that actually people in a civilized society were being shipped off to be murdered in a specialized death camp? Who would ever think that in Europe, emanating from Germany? Nobody could comprehend that. And so they believed what they were told, most of them. They didn't want to go to a labor camp. No, who wanted to leave their homeland and go to a labor camp? And so they complied with the different policies until this point. They were asked to sign registers. They were asked to fill out forms. So they did it. How many grandparents do you have? Who are your grandparents? Are they Jewish? And once, of course, you say that your grandparents are Jewish, then the authorities actually know what your bloodline is. And so then the deportation orders will be sent to the addresses. You have to report for deportation on such and such a day. The Dutch churches did not want this to happen. They believed it was totally wrong. And so they began to make their representations known to the Nazi authorities. We oppose what you plan to do. Well, the only problem was, because of the decision made at the Wannsee Conference on the 20th of January 1942, the policy was set in stone. Nothing could stop it. Nothing could actually divert the Nazis from implementing their plan to murder 11 million Jewish people. But they wanted to do it as quickly and efficiently and quietly as possible. So when the Dutch church leadership stood against them, they had to work out a way of breaking up that unity. And so they basically said, well, listen, if you stop your opposition to our plans, we promise you that we will not harm the Jewish Christians. Now, that wasn't even actually what the church leaders were asking for. They weren't asking for special favour for the Jewish Christians. They were actually standing up for the Jewish people collectively. But the Germans then began to say, well, look, we give you this assurance that the Jewish people who were baptised before the 1st of January 1941, I think it was, they're safe. And so as a result of that, one of the major denominations said, okay, we'll do that. We won't be belligerent in our opposition, and we will actually hold you to that promise. And that's why, in the long run, the vast majority of the Jewish Christians in the Netherlands actually survived, as opposed to all the other countries. However, the Roman Catholic Archbishop, one of my heroes in this whole episode, his name is Johannes de Jong, he realised, listen, we aren't looking out for the special interests of the Jewish Catholics. We're actually talking about Dutch citizens being taken out of the country against their will. That's what we're out about. And so he stood firm, as too did some of the other denominations. And so as a result of that, the Germans were very unhappy, particularly with the Roman Catholic leadership, and they said, right, we're going to deport you first. And so they went around and rounded up the Jewish Catholics. Overnight, they had their addresses. And as a result of that initial roundup, 113 Jewish Catholics were sent to Auschwitz and were murdered. More died in time over the following weeks and months, but some 113 died as a result of the opposition that was led by Archbishop Johannes de Jong. Imagine what it must have been like for him. Okay? He was making a stand and a bold principle, and then he actually realised that hundreds of Jewish Catholics died because of his bold stance. He didn't know, of course, at that time, that the Nazis had a plan to murder all 11 million Jewish people. So it doesn't matter what opposition the churches had, in time the Nazis would have implemented their plans. But nevertheless, there is a challenge for us, isn't it? The attitude we would have in the midst of such a terrible situation. How would we react? What would we do? I don't know how I would react in those situations. I honestly don't. I would hope that my faith would be strong enough, as Paul is stating here, I hope that my faith would be strong enough that I would be able to take the firm ground. That's what I would hope. But I don't know. I wasn't there. We can't judge from the way people did things back then. But I'll tell you what, we can look at the example set by Archbishop Johannes de Jong and say he was a courageous man. I hope that I can actually have the same courage as a man like him. But he wasn't alone, folks. He was not alone. There were many, many people in those situations who did what they could. There were many who didn't, but there were many who did. And we need to look at the testimonies of those who stood firm on the word of God and by their convictions. And my wife's grandfather and his brother were both involved in leadership in the Netherlands at the time. And they were opposed to Nazi rule. One lost his life, and my wife's grandfather was sent to Buchenwald concentration camp in order to silence him. But they didn't silence him. And he's a hero. They're both heroes for me. And so you had this situation whereby the church now had an opportunity at least to protect some of the Jewish Christians, primarily the Jewish Protestants. And so they were sent ultimately to a transit camp called Westerbork. Life wasn't easy there. And then they were sent, most of them, to Theresienstadt concentration camp, where life again was not easy. But at the end of the war, many of them had survived. But not all. There are stories of those who shone the light for the Lord Jesus right to the very end. And I'd like to just present just a couple of testimonies. I'm not quite sure what time I am supposed to end.
Another 10 minutes.
And one man whose name is Johannes Rottenberg. Johannes Rottenberg came from the Polish area. Initially came to faith in Jesus at a place called Elim in Rotterdam. Elim is Oasis. And this was a work that was begun by the ministry called CMJ. CMJ actually established a work to introduce Jewish people in the Netherlands to Jesus as far back as 1821. And CMJ began in this country in 1809, and then they began to work amongst the Jewish people in Amsterdam from 1821. And they had an incredible work in Rotterdam because there were thousands and thousands of Jewish people who were leaving Russia, the Russian Empire, going to the New World, and they'd get on boats in Rotterdam. And so CMJ established a presence there, a place there, and it became known as Elim. Because many of those Russians said, oh, we've encountered maras, we've encountered terrible things in our lives, but here is an oasis. So they call it Elim, which is Oasis. And so Johannes Rottenberg came to faith in Jesus at that particular place. And then later he became ordained in the Reformed Church and returned to the Netherlands. That was in the States, and returned to the Netherlands and began to work again with CMJ's work in Elim. Now he was a Dutch Reformed minister and he was Jewish. And in time there were two things which went against him. Because at the time of the Nazis, when they took control, they would actually send in spies to the various congregations, which had pastors that the authorities thought were not quite favourable to German control. Okay? And so they would send spies into his congregation to listen to what he was preaching. There was another Jewish follower of Jesus who was a pastor in the Dutch Reformed Church, Joseph Cohen, and they did exactly the same to him as well. So in time, these two Jewish pastors preached sermons that the Nazis did not like. And so they were arrested. Johannes Rottenberg, he had two sons and four daughters. And two sons, they also had to go underground, okay, dive under to get away from being detected. Johannes Rottenberg was captured, you might say arrested, in January 1942. And he was initially sent to a concentration camp in the Netherlands called Amersfoort. And because he was Jewish, he was given extra hard, what they call work detail. And I won't go into the details of what he had to do, but this man was an academic. Okay? And yet he was actually doing hard physical work, so you can just imagine how it would wear him down. And they forbade any religious services in their concentration camps. Well, have a guess what Reverend Rottenberg would do every Sunday. He would have religious services. He would have services and he would proclaim the name of the Lord. He would bring light into that dark place. But he got found out. He was discovered and he got extra hard punishment because of that. He was then sent to a place called Buchenwald. And I don't think he was there at the same time as my wife's grandfather, but also not a pleasant place to be. And guess what Reverend Rottenberg was also doing in Buchenwald concentration camp? also would be testifying, would be bringing the light of the Messiah into that dark place. And again, no, it's a no-no. We're shipping you off to even a worse place. And that worse place was a concentration camp called Mauthausen in Austria, where basically you were worked to death. Once you arrived, you're put straight into hard labour, and then you would die because of your hard labour, and more slaves were brought in. Okay? They weren't all Jewish. There were many people who were in the underground or the resistance in different locations. They were sent there as well. And after 2 weeks, he died. Afterwards, some years later, a letter came to his wife, Cornelia Rothenberg, from somebody who had been with him in Amersfoort. And this letter, this person testified, gave first-hand account of what Reverend Rothenberg had done in that camp. And that would no doubt have given some sustenance to Cornelia Rothenberg and to the two sons and the four daughters. That yes, their father and the husband had died, but he had left a great testimony. Later after the war, somebody else wrote and said that even when he was in Mauthausen, he led at least one, if not two, Jewish people to faith in Jesus as the Messiah. Now we might say that's not large numbers when you look at the broad scale of humanity. But folks, in a dark place, you don't need a floodlight to know there's light in the room. Just a little bit of light. And so I believe that he brought light into that dark situation. That's a testimony. That's the sort of person that I desire I could follow in his footsteps. But how I'd react, I don't know. None of us will know until we actually are confronted by these situations. But we need to hear these testimonies of what people did for the Lord. There was another group of people, Edith Stein, for instance. She was a doctor of philosophy in Germany, Jewish upbringing, became a doctor of philosophy, but she was searching for a meaning to life, found it in Jesus, entered into the Roman Catholic stream, then became a nun in the Roman Catholic Church, had to leave Germany, went to the Netherlands, and she was arrested. She was one of those Jewish Catholics that was arrested and taken to West Westerbork and then taken to Auschwitz, got off the train 2 hours later, or if not less, she was dead. And she also apparently just gave a great witness when they were in the Westerbork camp, and people have actually written about her testimony. There was a whole family of 8 children whose parents were Jewish, came to faith in Jesus, entered into the Roman Catholic stream. These 8 children did not know anything at all about their Jewish heritage, or very little about their Jewish heritage. Of those 8 children, the Lov children, 7 of them died in the Holocaust. 6 were in the monastic order, and many of those actually were arrested also because of that stance of the Roman Catholic Church. They had very little idea at all that they were actually Jewish. And that was the case for many people. They were second or third generation. They'd lost contact with the Jewishness. And knock on the door, you're coming with us, where are we going? You're arrested, why? Because you're Jewish. Am I? And the fourth example is a man called Ernest Casuto. Ernest Casuto was representative of most of the Jewish people in the Netherlands. He was very secular. Had obviously been to synagogue a few times, but not that often. And suddenly in 1940-41, he began to be told, you can't go to the beach. Why not? You're Jewish. You can't go to the restaurant. Why not? You're Jewish. So I better know, said he, what being a Jew is all about. He had a fiancée, Hetty Finkel. Neither of them had much of a Jewish background. So the mother of Casuto brought a Hebrew Bible and began to read through the Hebrew Bible. Well, if they're telling me I'm forbidden to do this and that because I'm Jewish, said he, I better know what it means to be Jewish. And then in that very time, providentially, he met a young man whose father was a Dutch Reformed minister and began to witness to him. And so he invited him along to a meeting one evening, and speaking that evening was Johannes Rothenberg, who challenged the young couple to read Isaiah 53. And shortly later, after having read Isaiah 53, They were convinced in their own heart, nobody forced them, in their own heart that Jesus was the Messiah of Israel. That's in the midst of the war, through the situation. He survived. His fiance did not. After the war, there were so many Jewish people, mostly younger people, who had been hidden by Christian families in the war. Many of them had come to faith in Jesus as Messiah. After the war, an organization was founded in the Netherlands called Haderach, the Way, in order to give sustenance to these younger people. On one occasion, Ernest Casuto met a young lady called Ellie Rodriguez, who herself had committed her life to Jesus during the war. In quite a miraculous way, actually, because she'd been told about this Jesus. Her father said that Jesus is not the Messiah. One day some Nazis got onto the train. She was with her, the person who was looking after her. And she basically prayed, "Jesus, if you are real, protect me." Well, the Nazi officers either didn't look at her papers or looked at it, gave them back and walked off. And she felt that was a sign to her that the Lord Jesus is the Messiah. So after the war, Ernest Casuto was at one of these meetings and he met this Ellie Rodriguez. Two people who'd come to faith in Jesus as the Messiah during the war in different ways. And it so happened that they fell for each other. Sometimes it happens. And later they were married. After they were married, of course, then, as it happens, children come along. Their first child was a girl. They named that child Hetty, after the fiancé, after Ernest Casuto's fiancé, who was murdered, who died near Sobibor. And in a sense, there's something very powerful in that. Because yes, the Germans, the Nazis, that Nazi system, that demonic system, had murdered one particular person, and she was representative of the goal to destroy all Jewish people. Yet they didn't succeed, and another child was born over here, and the fruit, or another marriage, and the fruit of that was with somebody else whose name was Hetty. To show that beauty shall come forth from ashes. There was light in the darkness. The attempt to snuff out, to destroy the Jewish people did not succeed. You see, if they destroyed all the Jewish people, they would have also destroyed the Hebrew Christian movement, which is very strong and very large throughout Europe in that period of time. They didn't succeed. The Jewish people survived, and in May 1948, the State of Israel was established. The Hebrew Christian movement wasn't destroyed, almost, but not completely. Many survived, some came here, some went to the States, Canada, and in time that Hebrew Christian movement became a vibrant movement and is now called the Messianic Jewish Movement worldwide. And so, folks, there is light in the darkness. There is beauty from the ashes. Yes, 6 million did perish, but there's a remnant who did not. And I think there's a lot for us to learn in this. You see, for many of those people, death came very quickly, unexpectedly. Who would have think that in a short space of time, life could be changed so quickly, and the result was death? But I think the message we really need to look at here is, what does this mean for us today? Those same principles are out there. What Jeremiah wrote about the heart being evil above all things and desperately evil, who can understand? That principle is still around. What do we do? What's our personal involvement today? Well, we must desire to be strong in the Lord and emulate some of those examples I've given. But at the same time, we have to realise that, yes, there's a death penalty actually hanging over each and every one of us. Whether you're Jewish or Gentile, ever since the Garden of Eden, there was the penalty of death hanging over humankind. God gave mankind that great gift of free will, and through the exercise of that great gift of free will, they disobeyed him and brought in its wake the death penalty. God, in his great love, wanted to rescue people from that penalty of death. And so he came himself, incarnate, in the form of Jesus, the Messiah, his son, Jesus took that death penalty upon himself. He didn't have to. He was perfect. He had never disobeyed God Almighty. But he came in order to die, to take that death penalty that was placed upon Adam and Eve and mankind. He came to take that death penalty. And he died, and then he rose again from the dead, and is the light and is the life. And he offers to each and every one of us that if we repent, if we turn around, if we no longer want to be in Adam, we can come and be in him, be in Christ. What does that mean? It means being in covenant union with Jesus. See, everything that Jesus did, he died, and then he rose from the dead by coming into covenant union with Jesus. We are one with him. And so also we die with Jesus and we rise with him to new life. So from death there comes forth life. That, folks, is the hope of today. That, I think, is what God wants us to focus upon. Not upon the conspiracy theories and all that sort of stuff. There may be something in all that, but let's not spend our time and effort and resources and whatever else on all that. Let's think about the life. How do we bring life into our society in this time? How do we introduce people to Jesus? Because, folks, we're here for 70, 80 years. There's eternity before us. Let's concentrate upon that. On that note, I'll finish. Thank you.